Another weekend of protests here in Jacksonville. Good morning and live from Studio 5, I'm Charles Griggs, sitting in for Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. And just ahead, we speak with Congressman Al Lawson on the November election, Florida's importance, and calls for police reform. The number to call is 549-2937. Then later, a local filmmaker who was shooting last week's protests shares his story of being detained by JSO. But first, this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. The state of Florida Department of Health has reported that 63,938 cases of COVID-19 were reported over the weekend, and an increase of 1,180 from Saturday. It is worth noting that Florida has also reported more than 1,000 cases every day for the past 5 days, something that hasn't been seen since early April, according to data from New York Times. Statewide, the Department of Health has reported 2,700 deaths, an increase of 12 from Saturday. And here in Northeast Florida, there are now 2,755 cases and 103 deaths. Along with that, the news, COVID-19 is still on the front page. But last weekend, protests continued around Jacksonville and around the country. Locally, thousands of people, including several city council members, turned out to peacefully protest against racism and police brutality. What impacts will these issues related to racism and criminal justice reform and police brutality have on the national elections, especially this year's presidential race? North Florida Representative Al Lawson is on the line to discuss this and more. If you have questions for the congressman, give us a call at 549-2937. You can also tweet us on Twitter, follow us on Twitter, and shoot us an email at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org for your questions. Representative Lawson, good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing fine. How are you?
Great, great, great. Listen, we understand that that yesterday there was a protest held here in Jacksonville and Duval County, part of your district, with elected officials, local elected officials. Were you a part of that protest?
No, I wasn't a part of the protest. I heard about it, and I think the same thing was going on at the same time here in Tallahassee with local elected officials, which I think is very good for local elected officials to really get involved with the protest that is actually going around, because they got a lot of decisions to make, you know, in terms of working with the police and the things that are happening in the communities.
So there are plenty of issues that local protesters have been concerned with, one being police brutality, criminal justice reform, and in many cases, overall policies related to African-American oppression in the community. What types of policies or specific changes have you heard people asking for from your position as a congressman?
Well, that's a great question. They're asking for the improving police training and practice, you know, to end in racial and religious profiling, mandating training of racial bias and the duty to intervene, banning no-knock warrant in drug cases, and banning chokeholds and karate holds, you know, limiting the transfer of military-grade equipment to the state and local government for enforcement, and requiring federal uninformed police officers to wear body cameras so that it will be available when things go bad. And, you know, it is requiring state and local enforcement to use existing federal funds to ensure police body cameras, you know, are available. And so, in essence, with all the things that have happened in the last couple of years, you know, you would really think that it is important to have reform, and you certainly hope that the police or the police unions and stuff that represent them will get involved in the legislation on reform, because, you know, we need the police, but we need to really make sure that we stop many of the things that have happened that is target African-American youth and also African-American self that leads to the death where people should not be dead. And if you look around the country, you will see not only in America, but globally, what is actually going on concerning police and police violence.
So we know that the death of George Floyd and as well as Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor have sort of created a tipping point for this type of protests and call for reform. Why hasn't any of this gotten traction before? And what has been the problem before getting the message out or getting elected officials, policymakers to respond to this?
Well, you know, that's another good question. I think what has happened is people always start a rally when something happened, and then it kind of goes by the wayside, you know, after a lot of the marching and everything take place. And so as a result, it's not brought up. You know, the families are trying to have healing. When they don't have healing, sometimes they file lawsuits and keep it in, but there's no consistent legislation that really come forward, like probably is going to come up now, to try to do something about the problem. Sometimes you hire people right off the street. Sometimes people are not well-educated that goes to the academy. And, you know, when you you learn a lot of these things in the academy, the public don't really understand it, but that's what they are taught, how to restrain and what methods to use for restraining. So now it's been so consistent and literally thousands and thousands of people who are concerned about it, and it's just not African-American, it's a mixture of people all across America. They want action, you know, and we should give them action. The question is, are you really listening to them? And that's one of the things that I think is so significant. And so I think it's at this point, you're going to see for the first time, you know, in 100 years or so, that there's going to be stricter guidelines put in, things that people cannot do, more monitoring and things that happen with the police and not swept under the rug. And I think this is good for the society and make people feel safer, because a lot of African-American youth right now really don't feel safe driving around, especially when a police car come behind them, when I talk to them and they say, you know, look like they're following us. Why are they following us? They're not following the guy next to me. And so, and it's just that anticipation that if you're out there at night and you're African-American, it's the opinion that seems like sometime with the police that you're doing something wrong.
Okay.
And so, that's what brings a lot of that on.
So also, we need to make sure we make note of the fact that the previous weekend we saw some rioting take place in various communities that almost overshadowed the peaceful protests. We didn't really see that this weekend. But what do you think happened that minimized, I should say, or removed a lot of the rioting activity that occurred the previous weekend?
Well, I think people were more conscious, and the people out there was really about an issue and peaceful protest that was actually going on. And then you have these looters that use this as a mechanism to destroy property, businesses, and so forth. And what they are doing, as talking to one of my colleagues in Philadelphia last Monday, when people got ready to go back to work, they couldn't go back to work. And we've had this pandemic that keeping them from work, and when it starts slowly open up where people can go back to work, and then these looters, what they do, they destroy the businesses, destroy property, they steal things out of store. And so now people are turning to each other and stopping those kind of people from infiltrating these peaceful marches. That's not what they're out there for. You know, it's always bad people in any kind of circumstances, and so the main thing is just taking them out of it.
Okay. Thank you for that, Congressman. We're starting to get some calls in, and people are responding to your appearance on the show. We're going to go to our first call. Greg is on the South Side. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. How you doing, sir?
Good morning.
Thank you for allowing me to comment. Congressman Lawson, I just have some simple questions. One, have you participated in any of the protests? And if so, why? And if not, why not? And lastly, we know we cannot legislate people's hearts, because that's where racism starts. What are you doing to talk to your colleagues on the Hill, specifically your Republican colleagues, and your colleague from Jacksonville, John Rutherford, to address these serious issues. I'll take the response offline. Thank
Greg,
you.
Greg, thank you for your call.
Okay, that's a very good question. No, I have not participated in the marches, for example. One was going on in Tallahassee. By the time I made it down there, the rain came, and people scattered in another way. Some of them you don't even know about. You know, they said that one of them going to be at the police station. Go to the police station. They're not there. They're down at the Capitol. You know, and so no one calls you about it. It's not on the news. And so oftentimes you can't find anything out about it, because I even called my staff in Jacksonville and asked them, did they know anything about marches going to take place? So I ended up calling the sheriff, Sheriff Williams, and he was telling me what had happened about three officers that was, one was stabbed or cut in the neck, and three of them was in the hospital, you know, and they're out now because of what happened. Now, what can be done to you talk to your colleagues? I talked to my colleagues on both sides of the aisles for the last 3 years that I've been in Congress. I've always worked on a nonpartisan basis, simply because that's what you had to do in Florida when I served in the Florida legislature, is to work with your colleagues. John Rutherford and I talk all the time, you know, about things that we need to do, what is facing Duval, what is going on, how can we monitor with him being a former sheriff. It helps a great deal to listen to people who actually been there and know exactly what is really going on.
So with that being said, do you think that... I'm sorry, I mean to cut you off, but with that being said, do you think that any meaningful policy change is going to come on a national level from, because the two of you are talking, your colleague, as well as the rest of your colleagues in Congress, do you see any meaningful policy change to address these concerns on a national level? What can you do in Congress to assist with local policies related to police brutality and over-policing?
Well, I really do think something is going to change. I talk to a lot of colleagues, and they believe that we need to do something, you know, and I think you're going to see it coming. You know, we are going to take up a bill this week in relationship to improving police training and practices. And so, and it's about 130-140-page bill that everyone would have the opportunity to have input in. There's going to be some serious lobbying by the police union and so forth. And I certainly hope that all of them will come to the table before we get something out this month that everybody can live with. It's not an attack on the police. It's an attack on those bad people that is infiltrated and work as officers that is causing damage to people. And we got to really change that, you know. And maybe they have too many responsibilities. Maybe they take some of the responsibility from them, such as the ones that are in the school system, and let the school system hire other security officers so they're not bombarded with all the time that they actually spend. And so there's a lot of options that are on the table, and I think that the biggest one is profiling, racial profiling, what we have in this country. All over the cities and stuff, you hear mayors beginning to speak out about it. So I think we can come together on a bipartisan basis and get some legislation out. You know, we want to protect people. We want to put police to protect us, you know. And so when something happened, who are you going to call? You know, are you going to call the police?
We're speaking with Congressman Al Lawson about the protests from previous weekend and weekend before related to the murder of George Floyd, as well as racial unrest in our country. The number to call is 549-2937 if you have questions. We do have some comments from via email. Do you think other GOP reps in the House want to improve police accountability? I haven't heard anything from Congressman Rutherford about this matter. Then again, I know people who want even a stronger police force against what they see our leftist groups from Black Lives Matter destroying America. You know, we have, of course, people who are looking in the middle for reform, but have a hard time understanding how that would come when both sides are so far apart on many issues. Let's take a call. Chuck is at the beaches. Good morning, Chuck, and welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning. I appreciate your guest being on, and I have a lot of respect for a lot of the things he's been saying. I want to bring to his attention, I want to talk about body cams. There's a lot of police officers who do not have body cams. There are police officers in Duval County who do not have body cams. I did not see any body cam footage from the George Floyd incident from the police officers. It's a law in the state of Florida that I have to have a tag on my car and I have to have my driver's license in my pocket. I can put my phone in my pocket and punch a button and I have a body cam. You need to make it a law. It needs to be a law that a police officer have a body cam. Don't tell me it's too expensive. If you have a police officer who doesn't have a body cam, it should be a law. And if he doesn't have a body cam on, there should be serious consequences. The idea that we have this technology today, and please don't tell me it's too expensive, every police officer should have a body cam on, and those videos should be available to the state's attorney's office and eventually to the public. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you. Thank you, Chuck, for the call. Congressman, is there a way that this can be addressed with national policy? Because we hear the conversation is all about local policy, state and local policy regarding body cams. Is there a way that you can do anything, you and your colleagues, on a national level?
Yes, there is. I really compliment the gentleman that just got who's speaking. You know, 2 months ago, I voted on a $2.5 trillion package. And right now, we're working on a $3 trillion package. There's no question about the dollars. If the local government is not doing it, then the federal government need to put it in the package, you know, because there's a lot of money that is available for a situation like this. He's absolutely right. Everybody should have it. It's a law. There's no question about it. And I think he's going to be real pleased because we're going to continue to work with this next package, which comes down to dollars for local governments, which they really need, to be able to purchase body cams and so forth, so it would cut down on a lot of violence and activity that people are doing. You know, it's amazing that the way we find out about a lot of things that are going on because they don't have body cameras is through individuals on their cell phones. And that's how everything came about by George. We would have never known, you know, about what happened in that particular situation because they have not released any footage, anything in relation to all these activities. It's just like the gentleman that was knocked over by the police, bleeding from his head, and people just walked by him. And the only way that we captured it was by a citizen standing there with a body cam in the hand. Now, you know, there's no compassion. Nobody would stop to help this gentleman. You know, people are standing around. That means that something is wrong with the training. And we got to change the way we train officers. Some people who've been on the job for 2 or 3 months, you know, they're very dangerous. And we cannot let them go out there by themselves because they're nervous. They're nervous to the crowd. They don't know how to call themselves. They don't know how to mingle with the citizens, especially that sometimes citizens can be, you know, off the chart, outrageous, and so forth. And you got to be able to handle it without pulling your weapon or tasing someone. Simply how to talk them through it.
So if body cam release is very important, one of the big controversies here in Jacksonville has been that the sheriff's office has not released body cam footage from the death of Jamie Johnson when he was shot by a police officer back in January. Of course, you know Jamie Johnson was a student at Florida right. A&M University. Have you spoken with the sheriff about this incident, and have you asked personally for the release of the body cam footage on this?
No, I haven't. I have not spoken to the sheriff on that. We've spoken about other issues, but not on this particular issue. And oftentimes, legally, the way the laws are designed in Florida and some of the things that the unions have in place, it makes it very difficult for them to do it. And so that's the reason why you need federal reform legislation to make this available when situations like this happen.
Okay, we're going to take a couple of quick calls, and then I want to shift gears to talk a little bit about the president's race. And I know that you're a surrogate for Vice President Joe Biden and his bid to become President of the United States. And I want to ask a few questions about the campaign. But before we get there, let's pull in Ricky from the West Side. Ricky, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you? Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to ask Mr. Lawson, how can he work with Rutherford, Sheriff Rutherford up in the Congress, when Mr. Rutherford considers Black Lives Matter as a terrorist group? Thank you.
Well, you know, we have to sensitize everyone. And not only if he feels that way, he's never expressed it to me. There are quite a few people that take the same view of what you're talking about, but you can't give up because they have a very important vote. And so you have to continue to work with people. You know, that's one of the things. You just don't close the door. Congress is very difficult, and there is a big divide among Democrats and Republicans. You find that out when you first get there. It was not like that when I was serving in the state legislature, where you could actually come together on issues. But it's a big divide up there. And then the other thing, the president makes it very difficult with Republicans because of his stance on a lot of issues. You know, instead of bringing the country together, they're keeping that divide. So you don't have a lot of people that are interested. You got to understand that a lot of members of Congress have been there for quite a long time, and they're set in their ways. And so when you come in, people sit in different areas, Republican over here, Democrats over here, moderates in the center. And so as a result, you have to continue to work. And, you know, I'm one of those guys that have always worked all that way. I have a lot of friends on the Florida delegation who are Republicans that was extremely helpful when I came to Congress, because everything is based on seniority. If you don't have seniority, you got to try to work your way through everything. So I think that I'll have those conversations with former sheriff, my colleagues now, and see if you got to change the opinion. And when people have those opinions, it is very difficult to change, but you can't give up. And the people don't want you to give up.
Okay, and Tom is on the north side. Tom, good morning.
Oh, the west side.
I'm sorry. The west side.
No problem. Just took me a second to realize you were talking to me. Good morning to y'all. The way I see it, I think we've got a problem that stems from the confluence of three things. We've got the increasing militarization of the police force. We've got the police hiring practice that emphasizes hiring veterans of those overseas wars, which are wars of occupation. And then we have police training, which emphasizes that their most important job is to return home alive at the end of every shift. And that creates a dangerous situation. And we see it over and over in video evidence. Most appallingly, we see evidence of police making abusive actions towards citizens and reporters, and doing this in full view of other law enforcement officers that have never intervened in any of the videos I've seen. We've seen reporters shot at. We've seen them assaulted. It's just an appalling situation, and we need to establish accountability for the police.
That's true, and that's very good. You know, in the 18 years that I served in the Florida House and the 10 years I served in the Senate, for 28 years, every year, police officers from around the state come in with their families to mourn those officers that lost their life while on duty. And many of them have been shot, all kind of things, and family are mourning and suffering. And we let them know how much we care about them. You know, from the governor's office all the way down, you know, we thank them for their service and pass legislation to help their kids, give money to their widows, get past legislation to help their kids be able to go on to college. But it's one thing that we don't do. We don't bring in victims of police brutality and try to do something for those families. And I think that we have to look at it both ways. I mean, we're all in this together. So when you look at people who have been killed by police, shot, everything else, when that is all over, it goes away and those families are left to mourn. And then attorneys come in and try to get resources for them. So I think when you look at it from a holistic standpoint, you start to realize that sometimes we are training the wrong people. Some people don't really need to be there. The code of conduct in these police departments should be that if this person is not functioning very well, they need to let them out, not to just keep them on because they're a member of the union or something like that. But if they are not appropriate to deal in the community, and then you need more community policing, you know, and working with different organizations so people feel comfortable when they come around. But that's Lou's right, you know, and so we don't want to get back up this week and start the debate. We don't want to do this to the police. We want to do that. All you need to do is listen to America, you know.
All right.
And,
so, Congressman,
what other people are saying, and that's one of the things that you have to do to be able to make change. And change is coming to America.
Okay, Congressman, I want to switch gears a little bit here and talk a little bit about the national election. As you know, we're pretty much in the phase where both parties start to get all hyped up about the candidates and be able to explain their platforms. And of course, locally, you know that Mayor Lenny Curry and other Republicans, elite Republicans in the community, have invited the Republican Party to host their conference here in Jacksonville, convention here in Jacksonville. What are your thoughts about what that would do to messaging for your Democrats' message? You know, Florida being a swing state and Duval County being a very important area for the state, helps decide which way the state is going to go. What are your thoughts on a potential convention coming to Jacksonville, and what does that mean to the Democratic Party and Joe Biden?
Well, you know, I don't think it would hurt our effort in Florida, but I do understand why mayors would say we want this convention because it's bringing a lot of money and a lot of resources, you know, and so everybody would want to say, hey, you can bring it here. But with this pandemic and coronavirus that we have, there's going to have to be limitations wherever the convention goes, whether it's the Democratic convention or the Republican convention, where people need to be distant. If you know that our cases in Florida are increasing, and ever since Memorial Day, because people are in close proximity with each other, and there's still the need for people to stay home, to do the things that they need to do in order to protect themselves. And the economy is slowly opening up, but our cases are continuing to rise. And that is a big concern. We don't need another setback. But in Florida, in one day, we had 1,200 positive cases. And so that's something you need to think about the convention coming in town. I have not talked to the mayor about the convention coming in town. I know we are still a lot of discussion on the Democratic convention in Milwaukee, you know, how we're going to handle it. Because public safety is more important than any of these conventions. You know, people's lives. 100,000 people lost their life because of this pandemic. And so as a result, we want to make sure that people are safe. And so it's a big deal. I mean, it would change a whole lot of things in terms of Jacksonville. You'll see a lot of demonstrations that always take place. And so we don't know what's going to happen in that regard.
Congressman Al Lawson, there's so many other issues I'd like to get to talk with you about and discuss here on the air. But we do appreciate your time and for coming on and talking about getting in what we could for this short period, for this short moment. We'll look to see what actions and activities come in the next few months and days ahead. And we welcome you back to the show anytime.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's a real privilege. And be safe out there and keep encouraging the people to practice safety as related to the pandemic. It's not over, and we want them. We want to save lives.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All righty.
All right. Much more still ahead. Later, WJCT is changing things up here a little bit with all news and talk format. We'll tell you about it. But up next,
either two or one officer came up from behind me, yoked me up, and then threw me to the ground to arrest.
A local filmmaker gets detained by police as he tries to shoot last week's protests. We'll be right back.
Woodcraft offers Father's Day gift certificates for woodworking tools, supplies, and classes for new and experienced woodworkers. Locally owned since 2003, Woodcraft is located in St. John's Plaza at Beach Boulevard and St. John's Bluff. Woodcraft, helping you make woodwork.
The Voidcast from WJCT is a musical journey through Northeast Florida. I'm the host, Void Magazine editor Matt Shaw. Join me while I cut through the digital noise to share hand-picked local music stories. WJCT.org/Voidcast.
Electro Lounge can now be heard Monday through Fridays at 10 p.m. till midnight and Saturdays from 9 to 11. Join us at the Electro Lounge only on 89.9 WJCT.
Introducing the Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT, offering music lovers a variety of ways to enjoy favorite artists and discover new genres. Download the WJCT app or visit WJCT.org/JaxMusic to start listening today.
During last week's protests, dozens of people were arrested in Jacksonville, and some of those people were actually claiming that they weren't doing anything wrong. One of them is local documentary filmmaker Bernardo Santana. Santana is an Emmy Award-winning producer and was shooting the protest for a future project. But his work got cut short when police grabbed him from behind and arrested him in front of Duval County Courthouse. He shared his story with Melissa Ross.
Santana, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us, Melissa.
So you are an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, photographer, video production expert in this city. You decided to go downtown this weekend to get some video of the protests that were going on, and you got caught up in everything that happened down there. What happened?
Yeah, well, I became part of the story, which is not something I usually like to do. I was downtown capturing some images, and to just like kind of backtrack, this was on Sunday, and it was a peaceful protest, and I thought the day was going pretty well. I got there, about 1 o'clock, I think, something like that. Yeah, it was early, and it was pretty calm. And throughout the day, things started to kind of heat up, I guess, or escalate. We had some black motorcyclists come through, and that's when things went from quiet to people just voicing their opinions, because what they did, the JSO did, is block these guys off of an open road that they weren't allowed to pass.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody that was in front of the courthouse came to the west side of the courthouse, and obviously started speaking their voices, standing side, across the street from these black motorcyclists that were trying to get up the street. And things got a little heated up there. But then, it all got dispersed. They all went back to the front of the courthouse. And once that happened, I had to go run an errand at my dad's house. So I went to my dad's, and on our way back, Shannon and I, my fiance, saw the protest coming back through again. So one of my friends, who is another filmmaker, we parked the car, caught up with him, and started heading towards the front of the courthouse. This is probably about 4:30, I think. I'm pretty sure it's about that time.
Okay. So you get there, and then things took a turn, right?
Well, it was peaceful. Again, it was peaceful. But then you start seeing on both sides of the courthouse, the east side and the west side, of JSO riot police officer, or police officer in riot gear, descending on the courthouse. And I noticed this. And then, I guess he's a zone sergeant or whoever, gets on the PA on his microphone and tells us, hey, we have to disperse. And that was the first time.
You kept shooting video, right? You just kept shooting.
Oh, yeah. I've got video all of this back. Go ahead, Melissa.
No, I was just going to say, the order went out to disperse. You kept shooting video. And then what we see on the video is the police come up to you and tackle you and arrest you.
Right, and if you watch the video, you will see that I'm capturing somebody getting arrested, heading towards the direction that I'm supposed to be going, because that's where my vehicle is. So when they start arresting this gentleman that's in front of me, you see two officers approach me, and they tell me to back off. And you clearly hear, and see that I said, hey, I'm cool, I'm backing up, and I'm backing it up. From that point, two or one officer came up from behind me, yoked me up, and then threw me to the ground to arrest me.
Right. I've seen the video.
They wanted.
Go ahead.
Now, I wasn't the individual that they instructed to arrest. In the video, you hear the zone sergeant or whoever the guy who commanded his officers to arrest that guy, the guy that was asking for his name and badge. He clearly pointed that guy out. You see it in the video.
So you right. get arrested, you get arrested, they throw you in the paddy wagon, and they take you downtown. Well, you really already are downtown, but they take you to the lockup, right? And then what happens?
No, they haven't even taken you. I'm in the paddy wagon for like 2 or 3 hours before they take me to JSO, or down to the jail, over by the K-9 unit, where I'm actually pulled out of the van, get my plastic cuffs cut off, and then shackled from hand to feet.
Yeah, and you were in police custody for about 24 hours, right?
I was in jail for 24 hours.
In jail. And what was that like?
It's interesting you asked me that, Melissa, because, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic, yet there was no social distancing. There was no recommended face mask. Or even they didn't recommend or provide us, right? We are herded into the jail together, no social distancing. Obviously, yeah, there's no social distancing in the back of the paddy wagon. And when I get through the courts there, to the court before the court system, we are herded into, I want to say, maybe a, what do you call it, 8x8, maybe 10x10 with 20 people in it. And then guess what happened? When we go to court, guess what they want to do? They want to social distance us. Isn't that interesting?
After 24 hours of not. Okay. So
exactly.
So to recap, you are media. You're filming the events. You're planning to distribute that content once you get it shot. You get arrested. You spend the night in jail. And you get exposed potentially to coronavirus because there's no social distancing in these conditions, as you say. Then you get released. Now you will have to raise money, I guess, for attorney's fees because people that have been arrested in these sweeps are facing charges, right?
Right. Well, let's back it up, too. Let's go back to court. My original bond was $750. It doubled when I showed up to court at $1,500. Why is that? Are they trying to make examples of these kids and myself?
I don't know.
That's a question that needs to be answered. And another question I want to know that, you know, that a question that hasn't been answered, when was it determined this was an unlawful assembly? Nobody is asking that question. I got interviewed the other day, 2 days in a row, and I've asked this question, and yet nobody has answered it.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, you were standing on a public sidewalk filming. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So how much money do you need to raise then to, and what are you facing in the way of charges?
Unlawful assembly, and if I'm convicted, 7 days in jail. All right. And other people got, if they were convicted, it's 5. I'm not sure why I'm getting 7 and some people are getting 5, you know. And either way, I'm raising money for myself because the attorney that I have, he has a fund. But he has a fund for these protesters. I was not a protester, you know. And I don't want to dip into those because they offered it. But I was like, no, I have friends. I have family members that can help me out. It's all about making the ask.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. I started a GoFundMe.
You started a GoFundMe. So then after the experience you've been through, and obviously this is a really divisive issue, how people see these protests, what would be your takeaway for everyone listening to hearing your story right now?
There's always two sides to a story, you know, and that's where I'm at right now. I have this footage, I have this content, and for some reason I became part of the story. And how do I, as a documentary filmmaker, come to the table with the content I have to portray both sides of the story, you know? And it's just like, for me, what I would like to see is our community and our police department come together and sit down and talk. And I don't know if that's happening. You know, I don't know if that's happening. There seems to be this constant divide. You know, when I posted my video up, I had people share, and I'm starting to see the divide in the shares. You know, the narrative, oh, is it because he's a brown man with tattoos? No, that's not what I want. That's not what the purpose of this video is, for me to post this video. What the video shows is I was unlawfully detained, I feel, you know, from behind. And let me add this to you. They never told me what I was arrested for until I got to processing in jail. You know, my fiance is extremely outraged now. You know, she watched her man get thrown to the ground and somewhat assaulted and then thrown into a paddy wagon. This is not something that's never happened in her life, you know? So she's extremely upset. She's probably more upset than I am.
Well, you know what? I'm just glad that you're all right, and I'm glad you were able to share your story with our listeners. And I think it's one story out of many that happened over those protests last week. And this is an ongoing story. We'll continue to follow it. And I think your comment about the police and the community speaking and communicating more is an obvious one that needs to happen. And I want to thank you.
Right.
And I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And you can find the video of Santana on his Facebook page and this incident. So, Bernardo Santana, it's a pleasure, as always, and thank you so much for sharing this.
Thank you for having me on, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa. Great job. And up next, a look at radio changes here at WJCT. We'll be right back.
Organized violence against peaceful protesters is unfortunately not new. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will revisit Axe Handle Saturday in Jacksonville. We'll discuss Santa Rosa County in Florida's Panhandle and talk about the history of migrant labor. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Only 4 of the Fortune 500 companies have black CEOs, but
10% of college grads are black. So with pull-through rates, you would expect to find 50 black Fortune 500 CEOs today.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Why that is not what we're finding and what companies maybe ought to do about it, that's next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
For years, we've tried to figure out how to create a police force fit for the 21st century. Perhaps we already know?
It is mayors and county executives that appoint most police chiefs and negotiate collective bargaining agreements with police unions.
Building trust and narrowing the divide between the police and the communities they promised to keep safe. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Oh. I'm Emily Fang, NPR's Beijing correspondent. When I first started reporting on the coronavirus outbreak, I realized pretty quickly that this was going to be a big story. And NPR listeners were able to follow this story from the very beginning, because we don't just parachute in when news breaks. We're already there, in China and around the world. You can support NPR and this reporting by becoming a sustaining member of this station today. Here's how.
Donate to WJCT today. Text the word GIVE 899 to 44321.
Welcome back. Well, next month, WJCT is making some changes on the radio. On 89.9 main channel, you will hear all news talk format. But the music you love hasn't gone away. I have in the studio with me the two Davids, WJCT CEO David McGowan and station manager David Lufkin are here. And we're going to talk about this more in detail so that all of our listeners can understand what's going on. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Charles.
David McGowan, what's going on with on the radio? Why are these changes happening and what can listeners expect to hear?
Well, we're really excited because we've been able to introduce a whole range of new services, and that started nearly 2 months ago now when we introduced something that we called the Jacksonville Music Experience, which is, again, a cross-platform service, but that is, among other things, a home for the music that you have heard on WJCT FM for a number of years. Electro Lounge in particular, David Lufkin is right here.
15 years.
His brainchild and creation. And we've been able to expand that service now into a full 24-hour service available on HD4 or on streaming services on the app and so forth. So, you know, we're really excited about that, and it provides a great way for people to listen to the music that they've come to love in the evenings on WJCT.
So actually, there's more music. I've heard from some friends and they're lamenting Electro Lounge. It was only 2 hours a day right now. Mm-hmm, now it's 24 hours a day.
Yes.
And it's everywhere you want to be, because all you got to do is pull out your smartphone and hook it to your Bluetooth speaker or in your car, and Electro Lounge is on. So don't worry, folks. The music actually is, there's more music now. We've revamped Relax and turned it into Anthology, and now it's really great 60s, 70s, and 80s music.
But all that has really been a precursor to the changes that we're going to make on 89.9, the station that you're listening to right now. Mm-hmm. And that is really, it's an evolutionary change. It's really not a radical change. But we are going to be moving to an all-news talk format, which means really that starting at 9 o'clock at night and during Monday to Fridays, when Electro Lounge used to come on, we'll be presenting a series of new news programs, including the News Hour from PBS, Talk, a new talk program. A program that comes out. I should think before I talk, actually, right?
The two go together.
a new program that coming out of KERA in Dallas, and a range of other programming, including some great new programs on the weekend. New Yorker Radio Hour.
We've got a PRX, a lot of great programs from all of our vendors that cover everything from podcasts and a weekend edition of Fresh Air, a weekend edition of Science
Friday. It's been a
Friday,
minute with Sam Sanders.
The New Yorker Radio Hour. So we're adding 13 new programs, and we've only moved three. We moved Electro Lounge, Jazz Night in America, and Live from Here to our HD channels. So it's not as big a change as people think on the main channel. We've just moved the music, but all the great programs you've come to expect are still on 89.9 on the talk and information side, plus 13 new programs.
So the news talk format is really born out of necessity because this is what people are looking for. They're looking for more information. They're looking for a variety of resources for information. And so this is how you arrive at this decision to do this?
It is. I mean, we did, 2 years ago when I arrived at the station, we did some surveying of our audience. We asked our audiences what they were looking for. And we've also looked at the numbers, Charles. I mean, you know, we do monitor the audiences for our radio stations, and we can see pretty clearly that our audiences are hungry for news and information. And in today's media world, mixed format stations are really hard because people want to know what it is they're coming to. They want to kind of pick a number on the dial and think, okay, this is my source for news and information. And we think that we have an important and increasingly important role to play here in Jacksonville in providing primary news and information to the audience. And so we have sort of dug deep and leaned into that role, and that's part of the reason for the change, absolutely.
And ultimately, everything gets increased. There's more news and information. There's actually more music.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, we're not taking anything away. We've just moved to a different platform. But there's more music than ever, and there's more news
because
than
they
ever.
More platforms available.
That's right. And people use them.
I mean, they do use them.
Yeah. That's right. And you know, one of the things that we've observed is that, for example, the audience for this program, First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross, right, there's, of course, a sizable part of the audience is listening right now on our main radio station. But more and more of our audience is listening to this program, for example, online, mm-hmm. whether that's on demand through a podcast, which you can get on our website, or streaming. So we've seen those numbers grow, and we've taken advantage of those new services. The other thing I really want to mention real quick, get in there, is that we are also increasing our local news reporting. That's been an area of emphasis. We feel it's more and more important for us to be able to provide that kind of reporting that we do here. And so we'll be increasing the number of newscasts that we do throughout the day and generally increasing the resources that we devote to local reporting. And that's an important part of the shift.
And we truly expect for our listening audience to support along with others. But alongside that, we are also participating right now in a pledge drive, correct?
Oh, we sure are. We're picking up where we left off in March. We were just about ready to do a pledge drive in March, and then all kinds of things happened. Yes. If you've read the paper, you know what I'm talking about. So we postponed our pledge drive, but we really do need to do it because it's budgeted. So we encourage people to give us a shout at 353-9528 or anytime at all, of course, online, because we do need those funds. Right, David?
We do. And as we talk about the importance of news and information in our community, there's probably no more important public affairs discussion in Jacksonville than this program right here, First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross and with our great Charles Griggs standing in today. And you just heard a conversation with one of our elected representatives. That's the kind of conversation that you're able to participate in as a result of this program and this service being here. So if you value it, we do ask you to please support it. That's the magic of WJCT. That's the magic of our model, is that if you can afford to support it, we ask you to do so so that everyone can benefit from it.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. We appreciate it. We're going to be looking forward to the new format. I know I am, because more news and more talk is better for the community so we can learn. And that's going to do it for our show today. Thanks to all of our guests, to Congressman for being here. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is on our digital editor. If you have questions or comments about First Coast Connect, send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Charles Griggs, and I'm sitting in for Melissa Ross, and we hope you'll join us again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.